This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Mervyn Taylor is here. He's originally from Trinidad, but shares his time in the USA. And we'll get to know him now and hear his voice with an opening poem.
First time seeing snow. There's that scene in the movie when Sinatra shuts off the wipers and floors the accelerator. You're a passenger. You can't see a thing. You hear the tick of ice, the whine of the motor, and you think of the song he was singing back in the bar, One for My Baby. You want to say, don't do it, man. Doris loves you. The way you turned when she answered the door, that hat. The car's an old Ford, and in the theater, your foot's on the brake long after you've struck something. And you sit there, Frankie slumped over the steering, snow under the tires, churning.
Oh, Mervyn Taylor, you bring the past and the present together so beautifully. What's the title of that book?
This is called The Waving Gallery.
And is that the newest one?
No, that was the one before the latest one.
Now, let me see. I've got An Island of His Own, 1992, The Goat, 1999. Mm-hmm. And we know that Voices Carry
is the latest one.
That's right. And then The Waving Gallery, 2014.
Right.
So you write.
And then there was No Back Door.
Every couple of years.
Yeah.
A book comes out.
Yeah.
That is amazing. And we have a new one to look forward to, which is called
Country of Warm Snow.
Okay. From Trinidad, how do you believe that you bring that to your work? How do you think being a Trinidadian poet is so significant for your particular work?
I think because I grew up hearing Calypso, listening to Calypso, and I know what the translation of day-to-day acts mean in terms of how you talk about yourself, how you talk about relationships, how you talk about the way your society is structured, you know. And those calypsos informed me from a very early age. My uncle ran one of the calypso tents. So I was always there and always listening. And the word came to me through calypso, and I think it continues now in these poems.
Well, we want to hear them. So give us two in a row. And I would like to have them know that you are also a visual artist, and you've taught in the New School at New York, New York Public School System.
Mm-hmm.
You have 6 books, and you have an audio collection.
Yes,
with
called Road Clear, with the bassist David Williams, David Happy Williams, who has played for years and years with Cedar Walton. Yeah. He's actually married to my cousin, so he's my cousin-in-law. And together we did that CD. We've been promising to do another one, but we haven't gotten to it yet.
If I know you, you'll get to it.
We'll get to it.
Here you are, yeah. Mervyn Taylor. We're at the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri.
This is The Stowaway, and it's actually about that David Williams's mom, Joan Williams, who's a wonderful woman. And you know, the women in the islands, they may not have had education past a certain grade, but they knew everything. They knew how to run things, and sometimes you think the men should just let them do it, okay? But
Do the men let them do it?
Yeah, but the men have no choice now. So this is about Joan Williams. Actually, the book is dedicated to Joan Williams, The Stowaway. And this is about when David Williams, jazz musician, was first leaving Trinidad. And in those days, you went away not so much by plane, you went away on a ship. He's going to England, and his mother's come to see him off and so on, right? She was that kind of mother. When the captain brought them up to the bridge, their skinny legs knocking through the new long pants, questioning them about the stowaway they hid in their room, whose passport was found by the cleaning crew, who was waving along with the rest of them when the ship left, they thought the ship would turn around and take them back, in shame, in distress, to face the neighbors. But he announced, the captain, the only reason he wouldn't prosecute was that the mother had spoken to him when they boarded, that he should look after their son, who of late was getting beside himself. And for her sake and her sake alone, you'll sail on to England. When did she do that, they wondered. How did she know the way to the captain's room, let alone his heart? She who had never left the port of Spain, who stayed in her room and made pants and sewed costumes and saved this coat from when her daughter made her first trip so you would be warm when you landed.
Oh, the new long pants says so much. How did you know to ask questions in that poem?
Because you wonder how an ordinary woman who's probably never traveled, never been away, can find her way to the captain's room to make sure that her son would be fine on that trip. And here they found him out. There was a stowaway hiding in their room and so on. And so they should have just dropped them off at the nearest port, right? Locked in handcuffs, right? But Joan Williams went to the captain.
But it's amazing that he responded so favorably.
Because of the way that Joan Williams presents herself. She says, listen, you take care of my boy. This is how
that
they do
is
it.
That is a great
This
poem.
Is what women do. They look after their own.
That's a great poem. Let's hear another. Mervyn Taylor. He comes from Trinidad and he has brought it with him.
I'm going to jump forward, and this is a poem written, well, you can tell in the older years, as we say, right? Stutter step. Old men don't stagger because they're drunk. Their legs just don't go where they want them to. They look distracted because they're thinking about some things they might have done differently. Old men are fools for wondering how they got here, when they started out for someplace else, even had a map. They retrace their steps and stand at the crossroads, looking this way and that. They almost get run over, not by young punks, but by other old men whose shirts are buttoned the wrong way, who slap away the wife's hand, insisting they can do it themselves. They call a friend, and when he no longer answers, they cradle the phone quietly, emitting one of those long sighs that only a lover from the very distant past can hear. She who died in the back of a taxi cab, or suddenly on a cruise, somewhere out in the middle of the Atlantic, when their song was playing. Old men do the stutter step, a kind of dance that comes naturally to them, a hesitation, while their feet try to figure the next move.
That should be a nationally known poem. That is a very important poem. I don't think I've read anything at all like it. Shirts are buttoned the wrong way.
And then they slap away the wife's hand when she tries to fix it. That's what men do, right?
It's so true. But do women do these things, or just old men?
I think just old men.
I think
ego,
you're right.
Big ego. Well, they're used to doing things for themselves, right? And then when they begin to lose that power that they thought they had, they're not sure how to respond to things. Right?
Very insightful.
They don't?
Very insightful. You've lived in New York how many years?
Oh, many, many years.
But you go back and forth.
Well, back and forth, but I've been in America now for some 50-odd years, right? And I came just for 4 years. I thought I was going to go to Howard and fly back home, right? Trinidad. And it just didn't work that way. I came here.
As Sterling Brown said, it just got a hold of you some kind of way.
Some kind of way. Oh, the great Sterling Brown.
And you
goodness.
Studied under him. And
I studied on it at Howard.
Carry his name forth.
Yes,
that's
I do.
The importance of students who are poets. They will keep him alive.
Yeah.
We need that.
And as a folk poet, the difference between the folk poet and the so-called literary poet is that the folk poet knows how to hold on to the very simplest of things, right? And that those simple things tell the whole story without going anyplace else to look it up or anything. There you have it.
You have said a mouthful.
That's what he did.
Yes. Charles Olson said, keep the dirt hanging on your roots so people know where you come from. Let's hear more poetry from Mervyn Taylor at the Library of Congress.
a well-bred woman. I should preface this by saying how what drove me to write this. My son introduced me to a friend of his, my son Isan. And when he introduced him, the young man said, he introduced himself as Amadou Diallo. And I said, oh, you have the same name as that young man who was killed, Amadou Diallo. And he said, well, don't be so surprised. He says, in my country, he says, it's a very common name. It's like John Smith or something. And that is what gave me the insight. I wanted to write a poem about Amadou Diallo, but I never found a way into it until that happened, that event, you know. A well-bred woman. She leaps to her feet, condemning the cops who shot her son. She turns into something primitive, screaming the American word for a man who sleeps with his mother. She puts her hand over her mouth as she hears the keys rattle and they are let out to walk free on the grass outside the courthouse where no lion waits to eat them, though she prayed for one. No owl hooting at the noonday sun. No calamity like a building waiting to fall on the black sedan that drives away with them down the highway. The reporters ask, and she tells them, Amadou is a common name in my country. It is like stones on the road, and there are many fathers named Diallo, who all rush out when they hear the drums saying, your son, your son, your son, Amadou. They look everywhere, in the home, in the compound, in the cassava fields down by the riverbank where the crocodiles steal the goats. They search until they remember the one who went to America, and then they hug the remaining Amadous and weep.
What country?
You know, I don't remember exactly the country.
It sounds like an African country.
Well, an African country,
yes,
certainly, yes.
But
yes.
What I liked the most was you telling us that it is hard to get into a poem. To find your way in.
To find your
you
way.
You have the epic. You have the understanding. What is it that you have to get to get an entry? That's a very interesting, and I don't think, it's a mysterious question.
What takes you there?
What allows you in? You know the context. You know the backstory. What is the trigger? And so in this case, what is the trigger that got you in?
In this, it was the story of meeting my son's friend and he telling me that his name was Amadou Diallo. And it struck me, he said, it's a common name in my country, you know. And that was the insight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the beautiful thing about poetry is that you get to use the things that you like, you know. It's like a secret, you know, you can tell someone afterwards, right? But the goat is a recurring animal in my poems.
Is that because of your country?
It's because of the country, but it's also because of my father. My father worked on the railroad. He was a railway conductor. And then when he retired, he had goats. And I couldn't, and it's an interesting story. He said to me one day, he said, would you like a pet? In Trinidad parlance, you want a pet? I say, sure. I'm thinking dog. And then he brings this Angora, this big white goat, you know, and she was kind of mean too, you know, Sally, you know, and I'm trying to pet her, and goat's hairs are not soft, you know, they're stiff, you know, and I'm trying to pet this goat, you know, and I said, oh my God, my father brought a goat for the pet. And we had an almond tree in the yard, and the almond tree became like an umbrella because the goats would eat all the lower leaves and then leave the ones on the top. So we had this umbrella in the yard, you know. And these goats, and I'll extend this a little more. My father was always a very quiet man. He didn't say much, you know. He wasn't mean, but just very, very, you know, to himself. The neighbors would say, good morning, Mr. Taylor. You'd get a humph if you liked, you know. But he was wonderful. But I remember not knowing much about tenderness because he wasn't very what you might call affectionate, right? But I remember once one of the kids got sick, one of the small goats, and there was a hole in its side, you know. And I remember looking out in the yard and my father was sitting on a low stool on a bench with his fingers in that hole, cleaning out, very deliberately cleaning out those worms from that kid. And it was just such a tender moment.
He has a big heart.
Oh.
Yes. And apparently it found its way into you.
It did.
Let's have another poem. Mervyn Taylor, okay. I bet you could charm us for hours on end with stories. And the goat is a very important symbol in your work.
Yeah.
So let's go on to a different book. What is this one?
This is No Back Door, and the poem is called...
Why is it called No Back Door?
No Back Door, because that's another thing that my father said often, right? No back door. And he would never, we would be going down to get a sea bath. You know, you go down to the seaside and so on. And he would never go with us, you know. And I said, come on, Dad, let's go. He said, sea have no back door. You know? In other words, you go in, there's no telling if you're going to come out, you know. Another expression from the islands is, sea have no branch, you know. In other words, there's nothing to hold on to, you know. And that was his
thing. You grew up with poetry.
I grew yeah.
As normal speech.
Yeah.
Well,
it's a land of calypsonians, right? That's all they do is compose, you know. Yeah.
Lucky you.
Day.
Lucky us.
Here's, you know, in getting ready for this interview, I realized how many poems I have about boxing. And I was never a fighter, but my brother was an amateur boxer. And I always wanted his courage. I always wanted to have his punch, you know. I wrote a poem called My Brother the Boxer. And I said he was feeling for the jab that had to be in there somewhere, you know. So this is not about my brother, but it's called The Last Round for Neil, who is a friend of mine who passed away. He was a boxer also. The Last Round. This is what happened after the doctors said there was nothing more they could do. When he had flown back and forth across the Atlantic, he went home and sold everything, furniture, clothes, car. Opened the gate and let the two Dobermans out. Go, run for your lives. When he speaks now, his voice is a rasp. That powerful body closed around it like a bell around the clapper. His stance, too, is altered. There's no fooling a fighter, especially the one he faces now, who keeps his hood on till the last minute, who closes in, knowing that the dogs are gone.
Mm-hmm. And another.
Here's a short poem for my son. And this is about him, when he was born. It's called Concern. Very short. The forceps left two bruises on my son's head, visible till he was about 6 weeks old. What kind of doctor, I ask, grabs a kid like that, pulls him like meat from the grill when it's done? Two green spots, as if the tongues were old, the first thing they could find. I find myself looking, now the boy's 40, for further signs of damage. So far, none.
That's a scary poem. You're a father, you're an artist, you're a poet, you're a teacher. You're a great storyteller, so that has to come into your teaching room, I bet. But when you enter the room, what is the first thing you want them to know about you or poetry? What is your entry?
The first thing I want them to know is that I'm learning from them as much as they are getting anything from me. Young people, I taught college, I taught at the New School, I taught at Bronx Community, and I taught high school public system in New York. And I'm telling you, these young people, poetry is part of their everyday speech, right? And I remember Derek Walcott said that early on.
Did you ever know him?
Yes, Derek actually taught me at Columbia and Joseph Brodsky at the same time. So I had just the best. And then Amiri Baraka came in on the summer program. So there we were. But Derek always said poetry is best when it approaches ordinary speech. You know, and This is what I think these young people have. You can't go one-on-one on them with satire or with puns and so on. They have it like that. They come up with it like that. The first thing I want to do before anything else, I want to see how quickly I can learn their names. Because you have 37 students in front of you, and you have to learn those names. Because the only way to get connected is to be able to say, John, Sam, Julia, what's up? You know, and that way, so that would be my first exercise for myself. You got to learn those names. You got to learn their faces. You got to learn mannerisms. You got to learn the ones who are sharp. You got to learn the leaders. You got to know who they are. And so they love to hear me break out into my Trinidadian accent. So the best thing that could happen is in the middle of all of this they go, yeah, man. You know, they try to imitate me, you know, and I say, no, you don't have it right. And I
oh, we're so glad to have you. And we want to hear more poetry. Oh. Mervyn Taylor is here, shares his time between his native island of Trinidad and New York City.
I think I'll read a poem for a man I met on Flatbush Avenue in Brooklyn, who is a tailor. And the poem is titled Status. Sheriff, the African tailor on Flatbush, wants to learn English. He can speak it, but not write it. He's from Conakry, a word so wonderful, I say it over, Conakry. I offer him slips on which to write the names of his customers, so he does not mix up the clothes. When we converse, I find myself imitating his accent, asking him where he learned tailoring skills so remarkable. The space where he sews is like a cupboard, his four countrymen squeezed in behind him. We discuss our cultures and talk about these new immigration laws, how they affect so many. I have no idea what his status is. I only know that when I stand before the mirror, my old suit looks new, and that I would hide him in my house and feed him whatever kind of soup it is they love over there.
Poetry could save the world. If everyone felt that way, it could literally save the world. There's nothing too little to write about, right?
No.
No encounter.
Actually, I think I gravitate towards the little things. Mm-hmm. The exchanges between, there's a poem I have called For Those Who Stayed, about women, the mothers and so on, who remained in the island while their sons went away, you know, and what they would exchange over the fence, you know, that I haven't heard from the boy in months, you know, and the other neighbor would, she would commiserate and say, did you hear that screaming last night? Something happened in the other street. And so those conversations between those people, they're not world events, but to me they are, because they echo in quiet places what people feel in reaction to world events, you know.
That's exactly what I saw in your poetry. I thought, how does he incorporate the world with the inner life? And you're explaining it to me, that the smallest thing is the most universal thing.
It is. It is. And it's what unites us, right? It's the mother's loneliness. You know, her son has gone off and somewhere. It's a shared thing. The big events, they have their own echo, and they have the people who will record them. But also those big events are subject to politics. They're subject to interpretations. Somebody will make a speech about them in a large audience. But you can't subvert the small events, the ones in which people exchange notes to each other. Because there's no artifice there. There's nothing to cover up.
And there's nothing to gain.
There's nothing to gain. Ah.
That's the best thing.
That's it.
Nothing's at stake. That is where purity and truth come from.
That's right. That's right.
Maybe that's a definition of poetry.
Maybe it is. I'll tell you one little story. Whenever my brother came home on vacation from the States, he left early, long before I did. And he would come home. And I remember his suitcases. And I remember there was a smell to them that I could never find the right word for. I was always, what is that smell? And reading Derek Walcott, Derek Walcott said, suitcases, a luggage that smells of money. There you had it. There you had it. Yeah.
Say more about that.
It identified it for me, right? Because there was a scent. I could not find what it was. But Derek named it, when he said smell of, well, of course, it's the smell of affluence. It's the smell of clothing.
Going someplace, getting back.
The ability to go. The ability to go.
Yes. Before we have a final poem, is life a pleasurable life in Trinidad? Is the standard of living acceptable? Is it amenable to many people?
Well, what has happened in Trinidad is what has happened all over the world, right? That drugs and those things have not left us. Nobody is untouched, you know? And because of those things, Trinidad is not the Trinidad that I knew growing up. And but of course your heart is still there, and the people are still. And people say, "How do people function? How do they live?" I remember when I first came to this country, people talked about Bed-Stuy like, "Oh my God, that's a terrible place. Nobody can live there." But when you go through Bed-Stuy, even during the worst years, people live there. I remember going to Trinidad and walking in an area downtown that was kind of not off limits, but kind of rough, you know, and so on. And I remember in the middle of a noonday, a lady who looked like old enough to be a grandmother, but she had her two kids holding them like this and coming through the crowd. You could see her rushing to get home, right? And so life is still conducted with all the joys and all the pain, right? No matter what the circumstances are, the shots could be going off, Harlem is still Harlem. People still have to get up, make breakfast, go to work, take care of the kids, right? So life goes on. So the poem, for me, has to address how those people, those very ordinary people, manage on a day-to-day. You can't say, how do you live there? I live there.
May we have a final poem?
Final poem. I wrote one for Toni Morrison recently, and I think I'll read that one. Okay, it's called Beloved, which was the title of her book, right? The day you died, two deputies led a black man into town between their horses, spectators lining both sides of the street, recalling the days patterollers brought runaways back in chains. The clanking heard long before the captives appeared, like this man, limping, the rope round his wrists tied to the pommel of one of the saddles. His eyes, fixed on a place far away, made us feel he could have been in one of those novels of yours, the child a mother had let live.
The voice of Mervyn Taylor. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation and the Sinipet Fund. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.